in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Matsumela Mapfumo, Reverend Mark Thompson, with you once again for this second Tuesday edition of What's at Stake. And glad to be with you and thankful to Vern Avery Brown and Katia Stitt for inviting me to do this segment. More to come for sure. Looking forward to doing more back in the place of my birth, even though I know we're heard all over the world. But WPFW is Washington, D.C., all about Washington, D.C., and glad to be here. We are going to have, I think, a very meaningful and worthwhile discussion today. And it is my position that with all we are facing in America, this renewal of fascism, modern-day fascism, this resurrection of racism and white supremacy, although it never really left us, but it's got a renewed spirit. If we look back at our ancestors in the civil and human rights movement, there was never delineation between the local struggle and the global struggle. Malcolm said, think globally, act locally. Dr. King traveled to Africa. Dr. King spoke out against apartheid. Marcus Garvey was a Pan-Africanist and internationalist. W.B. Du Bois was as well. Paul Robeson was. There's this thing we have to stay confined. In fact, last Friday we remembered Dr. King's martyrdom. And why was he killed? For being an international activist, for saying we've got to do something about Vietnam. 1 year to the day of that statement, he was assassinated. They don't want us to do that, but we're going to do it anyway. What about Africa? And I know we just heard the promo for Africa Now, so this is probably a providential segue. What is going on in Africa today? And we want to focus on probably one of the most important regions, countries we can talk about. Because the device you're listening to us on, most probably, the phones that we doom scroll all day on, the iPads, the tablets, all of these products, operate using a mineral that comes from this nation, a mineral that powers our batteries that are rechargeable, coltan and cobalt, for that matter. This country we're talking about is the Congo, and joining us now, one who I consider to be, first of all, a friend and comrade, but the most trusted and objective authority on what is taking place in the Congo, or as we also say, the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, our dear, dear brother, Kambale Musavule. My brother, bless you. Thank you for joining us here on What's at Stake. How are you, man?
I was about to say I'm okay, right? But in back of my head, I'm thinking about the people back home.
Yes.
We're going through tough times, but we're doing what we can to get the word out so people can get engaged and bring an end to the genocide in the Congo.
Let's start there, and let's try to educate the public on what we're talking about. Now, we'll come back to what I mentioned in terms of the minerals, but let's start with what is going on, the genocide. What that's about and who's involved, if you would, Kambale.
You know, when we first met, I think it's almost over close to a decade ago, I shared in your show that over 6 million people died back then. And we're in 2025. I'm still saying over 6 million people have died. The reason why I keep saying over 6 million people have died is No one is counting the deaths. So I could say very easily 10 million people die, 20 million people die. I mean, the numbers are quite big. But because there is no mortality study, the deaths in the Congo is hard in the so-called academic and intellectual circles to say anything beyond that. And say, well, where are your sources? Well, we know the names of the people who died, and we have not documented that. But since 1996, millions have died in DRC in the scramble for access to the mineral resources. For people in the late 90s, they will remember that we had these big telephones, right? They were so huge. And then as you got to 2000, 2001, the flip phones came in, right? So there was a change, right? There was some innovation in technology, but they did not connect it to access to raw materials. Because in the 90s, coltan, a mineral used in cell phones, was discovered. And in the 90s, the war in the Congo started. It started and is sometimes presented as an extension of the Rwandan genocide in 1994, whereby close to a million Rwandans, mostly Tutsis, were killed during the genocide. And what ensued after that is that the population of close to a million Rwandans crossed the border into the DRC as refugees. That's 1994. But within 2 years, two of Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, decided to invade the Congo. They used the pretext to come after those who committed genocide, and they have not left the Congo since. So from the 1996 to present, you have two African countries, not our brothers and sisters, who decided to invade the Congo. They removed a dictator back then, who was also backed by the United States, Mobutu, who was in power for 32 years. Many people would know him in the U.S. as one of the people at the center of the toppling of Patrice Lumumba, our first democratically elected prime minister. But after that toppling, what we noticed is that these two countries became the number one exporters of minerals from DRC. So today, for example, Rwanda is the number one exporter of coltan in the world when they don't have the reserves. So they found their way to the mines. But in the process of getting to the mines, people live on that land, right? So in the US, it may not be similar. People think about, they speak about gentrification. When there is prime land where communities live, how do you move them from that area? There are many tactics, right? We learned about how drugs were pushed into Black communities to displace them and so on. But in the DRC, in that context, an extreme gentrification is to get militia groups to go into villages, to go into communities, rape the women, destroy the community, the house, I mean, anything that exists, kill people, most of the time in public, to terrorize communities. And these communities leave the land. And in the process of leaving the land, we start seeing mining companies pop up. We start seeing mining concessions pop up. So the minerals leave, people are massacred, and these minerals find its way in our cell phones, in our laptops, in our TVs. And of course, it's a simplification of the situation, but to give a sense of, because of the fourth industrial revolution, this need of the new AI model. You know, we hear in ChatGPT, we hear DeepSeek, we hear in the drones that we are sending all around the world now to bomb communities. You can't have this technology without Congo's minerals. And we, the Congolese, have paid the price for now 30 years now. Close to 30 years, I mean, since 1996, while the world remains silent.
So the 94 Rwandan genocide and the resulting refugee immigration, mm-hmm. Which there were two ethnic groups we were aware of in the genocide, correct? Do I have the Tutsis and the Hutus? Is that right? Is those are the two?
Yes, Rwanda has three ethnic groups, but you rarely hear of the Twa. You mostly hear of the Tutsis and the Hutus. And the simplification of the Rwanda genocide of Hutu, Bed, Tutsi, died in a genocide takes out of the context of what happened in Rwanda from 1990 to 1994. There was a civil war in Rwanda from 1990 to 1994. And the assassination of two presidents, the president of Rwanda, Habyarimana, the president of Burundi, Cyprien Ntaryamana, I think that was his last name, their plane was shut down on April 6, 1994. And that's what people remember. A plane was shut down, Hutus ran out in the streets, killed the Tutsis, and then Paul Kagame of Rwanda came and stopped the genocide. That's the narrative that's been presented. But most people don't even speak about where was the plane coming from. They were on the plane coming from somewhere, right? The day the plane was shut down, the president of Rwanda and Burundi were in Tanzania to sign a peace accord with the rebels, right? They were actually signing a peace accord for sharing power with the rebels, one of them being Paul Kagame, who from 1990 to 1994 was waging a low intensity war into Rwanda, similar to what is happening. Every few months, people are massacring in different cities. And then it has created tension because you know, this was the rebellion. But through different negotiations, on April 6th, the president of Rwanda at the time, Habyarimana, agreed for power sharing. So they went and signed the peace agreement. On his flight back to Rwanda, his plane was shut down. And it's very important to point that out because any analyst at the time knew that if war started back after the peace accord, there would be a genocide in Rwanda. The reason why people believe that this would take place is because right next door in Burundi, in 1993, there was a genocide. And the genocide in Burundi was that Hutus were killed. That most people don't even know, right? We think about the situation in a silo, right? We don't connect the dots. Okay, Rwanda borders Burundi. In Burundi, a genocide took place in 1993, where Hutus are massacred. Right next door, in 1994, the president, who's a Hutu president, is assassinated. Right? Two head of state assassinated, which literally sparked the genocide. Yes, there were people who saw people in the street and say, you are a Tutsi, and they massacred. And the numbers, as I say, goes all the way up to close to 1 million people were massacred in the streets, mostly Tutsis, and even Hutus who also tried to protect civilians who didn't have anything to do with the politics, right? But I'm breaking that up because the oversimplification of that genocide creates a narrative where that same context is imposed on the Congo that, oh, there was a genocide in Burundi, there was a genocide in Rwanda based on two ethnic groups. So people try to put that same narrative in the Congo. Oh, there may be a Hutu and Tutsi conflict in the Congo. That is the extension. But that is not really what is unfolding as well.
So, and since you went down that road, let's go down, because we want to get really try to unpack as much of this as we can. Who was found to be responsible for the assassinations of both presidents and shooting that plane down, Kambale?
Up until today, there hasn't been a conclusive decision, right? We know, for example, the French courts, before Sarkozy, before Macron, did have a case stating that Paul Kagame, his forces, were responsible for the shooting down of the plane. We know today that France and Rwanda have great relationship. That case was closed and dismissed and is still put in the back burner. The reason why most analysts believe that President Paul Kagame shot down the plane is due to the fact that the missile that shot the plane came from a military stock of missiles that only the Ugandan military had. So I was speaking about Rwanda, now I'm speaking about Uganda. People say, well, what is that about? Well, the president of Rwanda today is a former Ugandan military officer. He was in Uganda as the chief of intelligence of the military. He was trained by the United States at Fort Leavenworth. And he launched an attack on Rwanda from Uganda. So the weapons that they actually had comes from the Ugandan military, because there were Rwandan refugees in Uganda who joined the Ugandan military, who were trained by the Americans, and then used the military stock from Uganda to attack Rwanda in 1990. That was October 1st, 1990, that they launched the attack. And in the analysts who follow the case closely, they've identified that that missile could not have come from the regime of Habyarimana, the president at the time, that missile came from the Ugandan plot. But for now 30 years, the world has protected Paul Kagame for accountability. Regardless of what people would say is allegation, right? It could be allegation because it's still not conclusive. For those of us who work on the field, we are very clear that Paul Kagame was the one who ordered, not just based on me saying that, even his own bodyguards who have left the regime were in hiding. One of them actually spoke in the U.S. Congress, who gave a testimony in the U.S. Congress saying that they were given the authorization from Paul Kagame to shoot down the planes. So even in the U.S. Congress record, this exists. But because Paul Kagame of Rwanda is a U.S. ally, because Yoweri Museveni is a U.S. ally for 30 years, this story has not actually held true. And we strongly believe, and I strongly believe, if the plane was not shut down, we wouldn't have had the genocide. So President Paul Kagame of Rwanda has a huge responsibility to what's taking place. April is Genocide Month. It's a tough time for Rwandans right now as they commemorate their loved ones. And after 30 years, what I share with my Rwandan brothers and sisters, it's important that the truth of what happened in the country comes out so that they can finally rebuild their country, not based on the lies of the current regime of Paul Kagame.
So was you mentioned he was in the Ugandan military. Was there a relationship between Kagame and Mobutu at any point?
No, not at all. The context of Paul Kagame, you have to know even who he is to also understand the class struggle in Rwanda. Paul Kagame is a monarch, right? In the 1950s, there was a revolution in Rwanda called the Hutu Revolution that brought down the monarchy. Paul Kagame, his mother is the sister of the queen. So during the Hutu Revolution of the late 50s that brought the independence in Rwanda, the monarchs, the kings, queens, and the whole family, they had to flee, right? So he fled Rwanda with his mother when he was 3 years old. So he grew up in Uganda as a refugee, and then, of course, joined the Ugandan military. He helped Museveni in his coup in 1986, right? The coup that pretty much brought Museveni into power had many Rwandan refugees who fled Rwanda in the 60s with their families. And as a way to repay that back, Uganda supported the invasions of Rwanda, and of course later what is unfolding in the Congo. Another line to also think about is the discussion around Pan-Africanism, because sometimes people believe that President Paul Kagame and President Yoweri Museveni are Pan-Africanist. They're not Pan-Africanist, but they run a very dangerous line of Pan-Africanism. They believe in the line of Pan-Africanism where they are what I call rebels without borders. So they believe in creating armed forces to go into South Sudan. I mean, we know that Museveni was involved in Sudan. And even when you talk to Sudanese, they speak about his participation in the assassination of Garang of Sudan. We know that they were involved in the toppling of the regime of Uganda. They were also involved in Rwanda and as well as in DRC. That these people who are creating havoc in the region have no national allegiance, but they have self-interest, because in the context of even them speaking about Pan-Africanism, they don't share actually that they're actually from the monarchy, right? These are monarchs with guns going around these countries, destabilizing the countries for the interest of a few. So even in Rwanda, it's a small group of people who are benefiting from that. Same thing in Uganda and so on, while they use the national narrative and saying that they represent the country. They are similar to when we talk about the Italian mafia, right? The Italian mafia is not the Italian government. But the Italian mafia is a particular family that have ties all across the world. So they run a mafia network that slowly now, after 30 years, people are noticing, wait a minute, why people in Sudan, in Uganda, in Rwanda, in Burundi, and Congo have died in millions? Well, because they are able to provide the resources to the West while the West supports their power to impose their power on the indigenous people of the region.
So as far as the Rwandan genocide is concerned, you mentioned the refugees.
Yes.
Bali going into Congo. Were those refugees mostly Hutu, Tutsi, or both?
They were mostly Hutus, and there were also Tutsis who participated, who were part of that. And the reason why I say that is because I know some Tutsis also were to flee. And you have to think about the context. From April 7th to about July, right, as the genocide took place, you had two factions. You had the government of Rwanda fighting the rebels of Paul Kagame. And in the fight, the civilians were in the middle. So people had to flee, be it Hutu or Tutsis, to survive. Tutsis were being massacred. Hutus who tried to protect the Tutsis also, some of them found death. But if I'm a civilian, no matter my ethnicity, I wouldn't be staying when bullets are being shot in the air. But the vast majority of the people who fled are Tutsis. Then you also have, are Hutus. Then also you have to know the demographic of the country. 80%+, some say 84% of the population is Hutu. About 12% are Tutsis, and the remaining 2% are Twa. So it's totally logical to have the vast majority of the population fleeing the conflict. So most of them were Hutus crossing the border, and there were also a few Tutsis also who were able to seek safe haven in the DRC at the time.
So are you saying then, I want to be sure we got this, a part of what is going on in the Congo, that genocide today is the residue of the Rwandan genocide being carried out by the Tutsi monarch, Paul Kagame, against the remaining Hutus in Congo? Do I have that right?
A little, I'll break it down more. Okay. That's the narrative that Paul Kagame wants to impose, the narrative that what is happening in the Congo is a residue of what happened in Rwanda. It's not fully true, because their motives, if what they're saying is true, we can't explain why they're going to the mines. Right? So if you say that we are going after those who participated in genocide to arrest them and kill them and whatever they want to do, why are you digging coltan? Why are you digging gold? So that's a narrative to understand that a destabilization process started in 1994 that brought in Rwandan refugees in DRC, which has been used as a pretext for Rwanda's military operations in DRC. So that's the framework to think about it. Even up until now, we have hundreds of thousands of Hutus who have not returned to Rwanda. They can't return to Rwanda. They are all a wholesale label as people who participated in the genocide, which doesn't make any sense. But what also I want to be very sensitive to is that in 1994, inside of Rwanda, there were people who looked at other people and say, you look like a Tutsi, took a machete and killed. That took place. So there was a genocide, right, where people were actually killed. But in that narrative, what people do not know is who started the genocide, who shut down the plane.
Right.
That's
right.
The current president of Rwanda,
right,
who was not held accountable. And then we, the Congo, opening the border, being hospitable, are the victims of Western interests via Rwanda and Uganda, who uses the pretext of a security issue in Congo to come into the DRC, while saying that they are going after those who committed genocide for not 30 years, and they never catch them, yet find themselves into the mines.
What is M23?
M23 is a rebel group today that has the name M23, but it existed in the Congo since the 1990s. In 1996, there was a rebellion that started in Congo. That rebellion was called AFDL. Right. Alliance des Forces Démocratiques pour la Libération du Congo, the allied forces, democratic forces for the liberation of Congo. This rebellion had a Congolese as the face of the rebellion. And that Congolese was Laurent Désiré Kabila. While he was the face of the rebellion, inside of his forces were Rwandan and Ugandan soldiers. We know that today. Back then, if you had said it, people would think that you were crazy, right? They came into the Congo in 1996. They were able to move from the eastern part of Congo all the way to the capital city of Kinshasa and topple the regime of Mobutu and install Laurent Désiré Kabila as the president. So if you understand the model of AFDL, this was a proxy militia group created by Rwanda and Uganda using Congolese as the face of the movement to make it appear as a Congolese resistance. That model has not changed. AFDL morphed in 1998 to another acronym called RCD. RCD in 2008 morphed into another acronym called CNDP. CNDP morphed itself into a new name in 2012 called M23, which we speak about today. So you keep hearing all these acronyms and you'll be confused.
Right,
what is M23?
Right.
What is AFDL? It's very simple. It's a proxy rebel group where to create a justification of the existence, there will be Congolese sellouts as the face of that group. But those who are actually fighting are the Rwandan military. And we know that because in 1997, the current Rwandan Minister of Regional Cooperation, James Kabarebe, was the Congolese Army Chief of Staff. So people may not catch what I just said. There are two countries. There is Rwanda, there is Congo. There was a guy in 1997 who made us believe he was Congolese, and he was the Congolese Army Chief of Staff. So the whole Congolese military, he was the one in control of it. Today is a Rwandan minister. But he knew he was a Rwandan soldier. But he presented himself as a Congolese. And today we know, actually the United States, a couple of months ago, put the Treasury Department finally put sanctions on him. And when you read the sanction document, you could see that the US even in the sanction says that he's been operating for over 3 decades. So if the U.S. Treasury knows that a Rwandan soldier who have received U.S. military training, who received U.S. military support, is causing havoc in the DRC for 3 decades, why did they have to wait 30 years to sanction him? So we know that the modus operandi of this rebel is to create that. So that's on one level. Two, the M23 has relaunched his attack about 3 years ago, 3 to 4 years ago, using the same narrative that they used in the 1990s, that they are fighting to protect a minority group, a minority Tutsi in the Congo being oppressed. They're fighting the regime in Kinshasa. So they use things that people are familiar to, to make it that their actions actually make sense. Mm. So what I point out to people is, if the M23 is fighting to protect a minority group in DRC, why are they in the Rubaya mine, which is the largest cotton mine in the world, controlling it, and according to the United Nations, making $800,000 a month just on taxing people from working in that mine? Not just exploitation, just that. $800,000, that's what they're making. So we know that they keep recycling the same story.
We'll be back, folks. Let's check in with the community calendar more on what's at stake with Kambale Musavuli when we return.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of April 6, 2025. Wednesday, April 9th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur study group session, the DC government's war on Southeast, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast DC. Registration and more info is on thewaronsoutheastdc.eventbrite.com. Join in process for a concert on April 11th at 7:30 a.m. at Seekers Church on 276 Carroll Street Northwest. For additional info, contact Sandra at seekerschurch.org or 240-350-1769. Nyame Kua Farm Collective will hold the Spring Quarter Giveaway on April 13th from 12 to 2 p.m. Co-Immunity Giveback, 4401 Capitol Street Southwest, Washington, D.C. Also on April 13th at 8 p.m., Sankofa will present the very first Amplify Artivism Tiny Desk Concert Series at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. On Friday, April 11th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Prose to the People, a celebration of Black bookstores book discussion will take place with Katie Mitchell and Paul Coates at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
All right, folks. What's at stake? I'm here hosting today, Matsumela Mapfumo, Reverend Mark Thompson. Good to be back in the place of my birth in Washington, D.C. And our very special guest is renowned Congolese activist Kambale Musavuli, and giving us a primer on what has been happening in Congo. We're going to get to some calls for those of you who want to go ahead and get on hold. 202-588-0893. Kambale, just to kind of round this out for the moment, and you've brought us up to the minerals and the importance of mining those minerals used in all of our electronic devices today. But now, in terms of the military operations, M23 is there. Is the Rwandan military also making incursions as well?
M23 is de facto the Rwandan military, not because I say so, because the UN Group of Experts demonstrated in the UN Group of Experts report published for the past 2 years that we have at least 4,000 Rwandan Defense Force soldiers embedded with the M23. And the reason why we also we know that is that they are using sophisticated weaponry. The UN Secretary General Guterres, in an interview with France 24, stated that the UN forces are inadequate to fight the M23 because they have sophisticated weapons. Even the UN Secretary General is afraid of them. They have night vision goggles. They have same vehicle that's a surface-to-air missile in the middle of the Congolese forest. How did they get that? From Walmart? Of course not. From the Rwandan military. So we know that M23 has names and figures of the people as the face of the movement, but those who are actually fighting and gaining territory are the Rwandan Defense Force soldiers. This is the reason why at the UN in February, a resolution was passed, 2773, where all 15 members, including three African nations, were part of the Security Council. They all called in a resolution on the conflict in the Congo for Rwandan troops to leave Congolese soil. So we know that the M23 is de facto the Rwanda Defense Force.
Right. But now, from time to time, Kagame acts, he denies, he doesn't know. I read recently where he said he doesn't know what M23 is doing. Where does the Rwandan military itself that shares with M23 or what have you, where do they get those sophisticated weapons from in the first place?
Oh, this is a U.S. and European military support.
You said U.S.?
Yeah, the United States and the European Union. The U.S. uses Rwanda for its interests around the world. They are U.S. allies on the so-called war on terror. They also serve the U.S. interests across the continent. So, for example, today we talk about the Kenyan troops in Haiti, but Rwandan soldiers were in Haiti before. People don't know that, right? They were there through influence of the Clintons, and they actually went there to provide so-called peacekeeping under UN auspices. They've been in Central African Republic. They've even been in Mali. And now, lately, they are deployed in Mozambique. And if you followed last year, the European Union gave Rwanda over 2 million euros worth of military aid for their operation in Mozambique. So all of them know that they provide them with the military equipment, military support. And then we're finding out that the M23 in Congo is using the sophisticated weapons, like they have anti-drone radar, like a GPS jamming signals. So we know that these are Western military equipment provided to the Rwandan military. So it comes from the United States, it comes from the European Union, and the taxpayers from these countries, while they struggle every day, I'm hearing that in the US, they're thinking about removing Medicaid. There are issues with social services, food stamp and so on, challenges with building schools and bringing even living wage. Yet billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money is going to support dictatorial regime in Central Africa, particularly in DRC, when they're supporting Rwanda and Uganda military.
And so, where then do the corporations enter? If you've got U.S. and European interests supporting the destabilization of the Congo while they are occupying mines and seizing mines, then can we then draw a direct line to the world corporations that benefit from those minerals?
Yeah, let's look at just what happened for the past 2 days. Last week, the special advisor to Africa at the State Department and an advisor to Donald Trump was in DRC. And yesterday, he was in Rwanda and he held a press conference. In his speaking, right, a few things happened within in the DRC as it relates to one of the American companies. There is an American company operating where the rebels are today. And the American company operating in South Kivu is called Alpha Mines. Alpha Mind, as the rebels were moving forward to take over some of the tin mine, right, BCA mine, and where the American company is operating, they shut down. The U.S. advisor comes in, makes statements about the rebels moving back forward. Guess what the rebels did? They moved back. And Alpha Mind made an announcement that they are restarting the operations. In the middle of Congolese being massacred, right? In the city of Goma, over 7,000 people have been killed. In the city of Bukavu, the numbers are going over 1,000. The North Kivu and South Kivu is under military occupation. But a U.S. tin company is operating like there is no problem. So who's giving them protection? How are they going to fly the minerals? We know that they're going to siphon it out through Rwanda, of course, and nobody will ever know that in the middle of where the rebels are operating and Congolese dying, there is actually an American mining company operating. That's on one level. right? On the second level, the European Union signed last year a 900 million euros agreement with Rwanda for critical minerals. Critical minerals are lithium, are cobalt, of course, uranium is part of that. And these minerals, Rwanda does not have the reserves to actually give them 900 million euros worth of minerals, right? So there is this MOU for 900 million euros for pretty much Congo's minerals that's on the table. Yes, the EU has put sanctions on a few Rwandan officials. They've put a sanction on the Rwandan gold refinery that's been also smuggling Congo's minerals. But they have not canceled that mineral deal. And if they haven't canceled the mineral deal, it means that Congo's resources, illegally pilfered, will be purchased from Rwanda through the EU agreement and find its way to European companies. And of course, you know, American companies are involved. And last, which is not related to cooperation, but I don't want to miss this point, is that John Legend, the American singer, should be called out for what he did. John Legend did a concert in Kigali. And it's fascinating to follow what he did, right? Because before going, a Nigerian singer decided not to go to Kigali because she posted on her social media that she didn't even know what was happening in Congo and she will not participate in this global citizen festival where they wanted her to perform. The Nigerian singer is Tems, right? Tems, the Nigerian singer, after finding out what was happening in Congo, saw that she was going to have a concert in Kigali in April, she canceled. John Legend, with global mobilization since December, telling him you shouldn't go because Rwanda is supporting rebel groups. He still went, and he was interviewed on BBC. And in the interview, he actually admitted he's very aware of what is happening, but the reason why he went, he didn't want his fan in Rwanda to miss out on the opportunity to hear him sing. So that tells me that he as a singer did not even take a moral stance when it comes to the millions of lives. And that happens with the corporations, that happens also to a lot of high profile people, that we have to build this movement of exposing those who are supporting the dictators. Of course, we want the Rwandan people to listen to American music from John Legend. But that concert, if you watch it closely, who you see in the concert? Paul Kagame, right? That you are actually propping up a dictator.
He was at the concert. He attended the concert.
Oh, yes. And yes, he's done that. I mean, even Kendrick Lamar had a concert in Kigali where Paul Kagame actually came on stage.
Did Kendrick renounce that visit?
No, he was there. So he's not the only one. Lauryn Hill has gone. Snoop Dogg has gone. So you have all these American artists who have not been educated about the situation, but even when they get the information, they actually dismiss the gravity of the situation. We are talking about millions, over 6 million dead. We're talking about evidence in terms of the deaths.
Let's get a call in. Caller, you're on air with Kambale Musavuli.
Well, good morning, Matsumila, and good morning, Kambale. This is Kati. I'll just say my name because people will recognize my voice. I have been so riveted to the radio with this clear and concise outlining of the origins. Really the origins and clearing up myths about the conflict. And of course, our dear brother Maurice Carney has done that also a number of times. But to your point about John Legend and Tems, and what I didn't know about the Tems concert was that it was sponsored by Global Citizen, which is supposed to be an organization, right, that actually is supposed to be working to stamp out injustice in the world. So the fact that the concert that Tems was supposed to perform at is presented by Global Citizen. Could you just speak on that, how sometimes these multinational NGOs or nonprofits that are supposed to be doing good in the world actually harm all of us, but especially the African continent. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Katia. Sorry to get you riveted since you've been on air since 5 a.m. I'm sorry you haven't been able to turn it off, but go ahead, Kambale.
No, I mean, I'm from the perspective that we have to educate people about what is unfolding. Even in the context of global citizens, I mean, Mandela's grandson is on the board. I think he's called Kweku Mandela. And he knew, we know through channels of mobilizing that we have shared this concern with global citizens, we have shared this concern with them, and people who organize this, that their actions is actually in support of a dictatorship. It's not in support of the Rwandan people. And it creates like a political cover for the crimes. So the more we expose this, then we start getting to know who's funding these concerts, which corporations are involved in creating this narrative. We start getting closer to the truth. And I keep saying all roads lead to Washington. Yeah. All roads lead to U.S. corporations, that we must expose this network, propping up these dictators while causing havoc on the African continent.
Most certainly. Thank you again, Katia, for your call. Next caller. Paul, are you there? You may need to turn your radio down.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. What's your name, caller?
Yeah, I'm Irat. I'm calling from Upper Marlboro here.
Okay.
Yeah, I am. Mark Thompson, you are an excellent journalist, very young man. I know you. And this gentleman that you have brought is a breath of fresh air about the information we get to know. Is there anything we can do to save the lives of African leaders who are burnt, who are moving towards the United States of Africa? Because Caucasians, as soon as they know it, they kill you as they kill Patrice Lumumba, or they kill Thomas Sankara, or this burden one that is coming up in Burkina Faso right now. If we are not careful, the Caucasians will also smother him, just like the same thing with Julius Malema and so many burden African leaders, African young people who are moving towards unity of Africa, but the Caucasians wouldn't let us unite.
Kambale?
I will go to Fanon in his book Toward the African Revolution, the last paragraph. He said, let us never forget it, but the fate of us all is at stake in the Congo. And the reason why he stated that, he understood that in the building of Pan-Africanism or Pan-African unity, Congo will be essential. And as long as Congo is not free, is not liberated, is going through this chaos, we'll have a hard time bringing about peace and stability on the African continent. I'm a strong believer on the Pan-Africanism of the people, not the Pan-Africanism of African Union, where you have a college of African leaders protecting one another, right? Mm. And the Pan-Africanism of the people, we are seeing it right now in the alliance of Sahel states. It's not the leaders of the Sahel states who are making a difference. It's the people of the Sahel. They understood what imperialism is. Imperialism is a currency controlled by France called Franc CFA. Imperialism is U.S. military bases all across the Sahel, right? And they educated the masses for that. For us to arrive at that, we must have political education of the masses. And there are people who are doing that. And us supporting those who are doing this effort will be critical. Exposing the leaders, but also supporting organizations and individuals within an organization who are fighting to transform the African continent. I will hope wherever you are in Upper Marlboro, you are engaged in the organization and you strengthen the organization to start providing the support to those who are fighting on the ground to bring a new Africa to light.
Amen. The next caller, please.
Is that me?
Oh, no. Yes, go right ahead.
Yeah, good morning. How are you? I'm just trying to share with you and with the guests that word is, when we say United Nations, it's a shame with us. United Nations, there is not a United Nations, to represent Africa. Yes, there are America, British, French, and Germany, and includes the European Union. And especially after the Soviet Union, founder of the Soviet Union, if he knows that I still have, it was 1992 printed by the New York Times that says, the younger the generation of Africa, come on. The mercenaries, yes. Imagine 1993, Sudan was hit. I mean, also they named them was Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Congo. Can you imagine? Then within a short period of time, that Sudan was invaded by the Eritrean and Ethiopian. And the second one, Rwanda, Hutu and Tutsi, two brothers. Then Uganda, then Congo, then 1998, Eritrea and Ethiopia. Come on. Who are the United Nations? I will say it to you clearly. The Protestant and Judaism, yes, after the Soviet Union fallen by Gorbachev, it was totally invaded to destroy Africa, and yet still doing it. They created mercenaries in Africa. They created their puppets for, controllers of Africa. Yes, I want to speak out Ethiopia. Abiy Ahmed, who is that? Protestant prosperity killer by propagating by the called ethnical base. Oh, Amhara, Eritrea, Tigray, Gurage. Can you imagine? The mafia moved in 1990 to Africa. Mafia used to be in New York before the Soviet Union was falling down. Can we awaken that? We should not call it United Nations. It is United Invaders. Yes, China and Russia are doing for themselves now. But we, the Africans, the black society of the world, are totally destroyed by these powerful four powers. United States, British, French, and Germany.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. Kambale, you want to react to that quickly, please?
Yeah, I think I appreciate his comment. And he's calling them mafia, but he didn't call them the Clintons. And I'm surprised why he didn't call out the Clintons directly. When he starts speaking about all these nations, right, there is a direct connection. The Bill Clinton, through the Entebbe principles, had a view of how to reshape that region. Every country that he's speaking is going toward the Horn of Africa, right? He had this vision of the so-called strong leaders, right, the Renaissance leaders of Africa. He picked Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, and Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, and strengthened their regimes where they brought havoc, which we saw and we're still living with here. So I appreciate his comments, but I will focus on making sure that the American people know that the Clintons and what they did in the 90s destroyed the African continent, and they have not been held accountable for what they did back then up until now.
Mm. The companies, well, the rebels occupying mines, even the ones who become operational again, you mentioned one mining company. What was the name of it again?
Alpha Mine.
Alpha Mine. Can we trace Alpha Mine and other companies mining and what they're stealing directly to Tesla or Apple or Samsung?
Let's go directly to Elon Musk. So Tesla gets its cobalt from the DRC. Why do I say that very forcefully? It's because Tesla has an agreement with a mining company called Glencore.
Right.
Right. And Glencore operates in DRC.
Right.
Don't take my word for it, but go to the Justice Department and you'll notice that the U.S. Justice Department found them guilty of violating a Foreign Practice Act and corrupting leaders in the Congo to get access to the mine. And they had to pay hundreds of millions of fines for, I'm speaking specifically for Glencore, right? Glencore had to pay a fine to the Justice Department.
I hate to rush you, Kamala. We got about a minute left. So go ahead, finish.
Right. So Tesla gets cobalt from Glencore, found guilty. So people should not buy Tesla products because they're directly implicated. finally, you can get further information about who is connected to who in DRC. If you go to freecongo.org and you sign up, we'll send you information about companies and, more importantly, actions to support Congolese who are fighting to transform their country. I know we have a very short time, but I'm glad that we were able to bring this story to light for people to know. Congolese are resisting. We're still pushing for Patrice Lumumba's ideals for transformation in the heart of Africa.
No question. Kambale Musavuli, our guest. This is Matsumela Mapfumo, Reverend Mark Thompson. Glad to be with you on What's at Stake this second Tuesday. Stay tuned for more right here on WPFW-FM.
WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration, on Friday, April 25th, from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Everam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Hola, mi gente. Soy Oscar Fernandez del Latino Media Collective en WPFW, aquí para decirle a ustedes que todas las personas en los Estados Unidos tienen derechos independientemente de su estado migratorio, y conociendo nuestros derechos es el primer paso para mantenernos a distancia de las violaciones de nuestros derechos como ICE y otras fuerzas de orden. Por eso le presento una guía para proteger sus derechos. Número 1. Identifique los contactos de emergencia y memorice sus números. Número 2. Mantenga la calma si se acerca el ICE u otras fuerzas del orden. No corra, discuta, resista ni pelea. Número 3. Tenemos el derecho a permanecer en silencio. Número 4. Tiene derecho a hablar con un abogado y no firmar nada hasta que lo discuta con un abogado. Número 5. Si está en su casa, tiene derecho a negarse a entrar a menos que se le presente una orden judicial firmada por un juez. Una orden de ICE no permite la entrada a su casa. Y finalmente, número 6, usted tiene derecho a un intérprete. WPFW está aquí defendiendo los derechos humanos ganados con dificultad, construyendo un mundo más justo, transmisión a transmisión.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m.